Welcome, everyone, to episode 72 of Underserved. Today, joining me in studio, I have with me Brian Durkin, Senior Group Manager and Head of User Experience, Data, and Analytics at BNY Mellon. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thank you for having me.
So when you were a kid, like, do you have a wow moment or something when you first saw technology and said, that's cool, I'm interested in it?
I wouldn't say as a kid. I went to art school and I was always creative growing up. So I knew that I wanted to go down some sort of path like that. And I was very familiar with graphic design and stuff like that at that time. But I went full artist when I went into school. I got my BFA, majored in experimental video and sonic arts and sculpture and stuff like that.
That sounds really cool. You must have made some cool stuff.
I did. My whole philosophy was, instead of taking my artwork and putting it in a studio or in a gallery space, I would take the gallery space and turn it into an environment using video and sound and sculpture and things like that.
That's cool. You went to Alfred University?
Yep, Alfred University, one of the best ceramic schools in the country and really big glass blowing program and stone sculpture and stuff like that. It's very, very fine arts based.
I saw that on the website. It looks like the glass blowing thing is still big to this day.
Oh, yeah.
So when you made an installation, like, what were some of the themes or things that you actually built there?
So one of the pieces that I made, I called it my metaphysical kitchen. And what I did was I set up 5 or 6 video cameras in my kitchen at home, one above the sink, one above the counter, one above the stove, one pointing at the oven. And then I had a couple friends come over and we all hit record at the same time. And I went ahead and I made dinner. And then so what I did was in the gallery space, I put all the TVs in the positions that they would be in my kitchen. So you would see my hands chopping vegetables on one TV and then they would disappear. And then like the knife would go in the sink. And then, you know, I'd open up the oven and put something in. And it was kind of cool. Like I made dinner virtually or, you know, in that space.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So what do you end up doing after you graduate?
Well, that's a great question. And that was the question that I had. I was prepared to be a great fine artist. And then I was like, what the heck do I do now? So I took a web design class at SVA and just went right into web design. It was a natural transition, which I was shocked and amazed at, but it really was.
Just like slinging HTML tables or?
Well, when I started, it was all Photoshop and nested tables. And it was a mess. But then CSS came out and some JavaScript. And, you know, I went down that rabbit hole.
And so was your first job at Best Web Corporation?
Yeah. As I was taking that web design class, I got a job working in tech support at an internet service provider. They were a very small local company that provided internet to like 2 or 3 towns. And I would get irate phone calls from people that couldn't connect their 16K baud modem and told me that it was my fault and all those good things. But it was great because it helped me understand, you know, how things work and, you know, that servers send information from here to there. And I learned all about the inner workings of what I wanted to design for.
Probably got force-fed a little user empathy as well.
Well, I think I got some practice at talking with irate people. And as I say that, I think to like recent business, you know, meetings and things of that nature where, you know, you just kind of have to put the smile on and go, yeah, no, I understand. Yep.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. So from there, you move on to a position where you're doing more like development as well?
Yeah, you know, so back in the 90s, it was kind of a natural progression to go from web designer to front-end web developer because there really wasn't a difference for a while. And I actually got good at it. I started doing a lot of front-end work. I actually ended up learning PHP and MySQL and a bunch of other programming languages. My first web design job was at People Magazine. The only cool thing about that job was part of my job was to watch Survivor when that was like, you know, the big new show that came out. And part of my job was to watch Survivor until somebody got kicked off the island. And then I would run to my computer in the office and I would start updating the website, like people.com.
Huh.
So this was like before content management systems and, you know, things made it a lot easier. I literally was having the editor send me copy, and I was putting in the HTML and fixing the sites up, and it was a lot of smoke and mirrors for that stuff.
Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. My middle daughter still loves watching Survivor like 40 odd seasons in.
I know. Yeah. But after that, I had a couple of jobs where I was really focused on front-end web development. Made that all the way until I worked at Nickelodeon for a while. I was working there for almost 3 years on a project called ParentsConnect.com. And that is no longer in existence. But for about 2.5 to 3 years, we worked on that platform, I'll call it. It was supposed to be like a community of parents for Nickelodeon kids. And they had a design. I don't know who made the decision, but some producer somewhere decided that we just needed a redesign. And so, you know, next thing you know, we're eating pizza at midnight in the office, like 3 days a week, just nonstop in their office. And we finally make it through this major redesign, and our readership dropped. And all of a sudden we started, you know, finding that people weren't coming to the site. And so what did they do? They decided to redesign it again. And then when they decided to redesign it a third time or fourth time, that's when I really got a little fed up. And I said, you know what? I need to start thinking about how to make products valuable and not just make the products or make them look good. How do we actually provide value to where people want to use something? And that's when I fell in love with user experience design.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
All right, a couple quick questions about Nickelodeon, because I was like a huge You Can't Do That on Television fan.
I was too.
Like way back in the day, like, did you ever get slimed while working there?
No, but it wouldn't be out of the question. I was working in Times Square in the Viacom building, and I would see famous people in the elevators and stuff, and it was a blast. There was TVs, and SpongeBob was everywhere, and it was just fun.
That's cool. They were part of MTV Networks then, or?
Yeah. So I don't know if it's still structured this way, but it was Nickelodeon is part of MTV Networks, and then MTV Networks is part of Viacom, and then Viacom is also part of Paramount. I don't know. Yeah. You know what I mean.
It's confusing, because I was watching Yellowstone the other day, and like they have the little like logo in the beginning, and it's MTV Networks that produces it.
It was cool because I would see like all the MTV people and, you know, all the different brands.
So now that you've seen what happens when there's not a lot of credence given to design or the actual end user, and you're just kind of shotgunning, what do you decide to do next about that?
That's when I joined a couple of organizations. I joined the Interaction Design Association, the IXDA. I was going to UXPA events and then whatever meetups I could go to. And that's when General Assembly was just getting started, really. And I was taking classes there, too, just so I could learn more about design and, you know, why things weren't working at Nickelodeon. You know, eventually I got to a point where I decided to leave, and I made the conscious decision to go work for a place that could provide me with examples of good UX work. So I worked for some agencies that had UX designers, had people creating wireframes and creating design pattern libraries and things like that. It was my way of going back to school, was to get a front-end web development job, but at a place that knew what they were doing when it came to UX.
Which agencies were you working at?
I worked at Huge. They had a big office in Brooklyn, and that's where I was working then. And then I ended up moving from there to a company called RoundArch, which I think they got purchased by Isobar. So I was working for both those companies for about a year and a half, 2 years. And then I was going to do it again, and I was going to go a third time to just go somewhere else to get more exposure. And I went to this company, Foundry 9, where it was a very small agency downtown Manhattan. And I went into the interview, and I was interviewing for a front-end web development position. Halfway through the interview, I kind of stopped, and I told the guy, I said, I'm sorry, I don't want to waste any more of your time, but I'm coming to the realization that I really don't want to do any kind of web development ever again. Don't want to be a web developer, and I'm going to go home now.
I'm ending this interview.
And, you know, the guy across from me, he kind of smiled and he was intrigued. So he poked and he said, so what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a user experience designer. And he said, well, what's that? And so I started to explain it. And he knew it in terms of information architecture at that time. So he said, well, we don't have user experience designers, but we have an information architect. And, you know, we don't have anything open right now, but, you know, let's keep in touch. And I said, absolutely. You know, it was great to meet them. And I figured I'd never hear from them again. But I actually heard from them the next day. And they called me up and they said, hey, Brian, we've got an entry level junior information architect position opening up for you. So we'd like for you to apply. And they gave me a take it home test, which is fairly common now. So the test involved me coming up with an app and creating wireframes and, you know, going through and explaining the user flows and the user scenarios and how it worked and everything. And they really liked it. They really appreciated the fact that I actually didn't even have any software to complete that work. So what I had to do was downloaded the 30-day trial of OmniGraffle. And then I went through and I created all the documentation. And I even told them about it. And I think that helped them understand that I was so passionate about what I'm doing that I was willing to figure out any way to do it.
Showing resourcefulness is always a good thing on an interview or while you're working.
Yeah, yeah.
So you get in the door there. What do you end up doing?
That's actually where I learned about mentoring. I had a great mentor when I worked there. My manager, Charles Zakari, he's a phenomenal UX IA master. And he taught me a lot about information architecture and really what it is and, you know, how the organization of content on the page has so many different aspects to making sure something is understandable, useful, usable, desirable, credible, findable, all those great things that make a product valuable. And then at the same time, he also kind of filled me in on how to create the deliverables. So what is a wireframe? Why do we need wireframes? Like, by the way, I don't use wireframes anymore, but
really,
I tell people that I killed wireframes and they're in my sketchbook and that prototype is more the way to go.
So more of like a full FI clickable thing that you can use or?
Yeah, any way that you can get to a place of describing interaction as quickly as possible, that's the best way to get to validate that hypothesis. You know, that's one of the things that I've really understood through my career of getting into UX is that all design is a hypothesis, that nobody knows if the design is going to work or not until you put it in front of users and talk to them. Because everybody that works on a product, they are not the users. So it's, you know, usually in the past, at least, you know, somebody would come up with a great idea. And then everybody else would, you know, the highest paid person in the office would say that. And everybody would clap and they'd go, okay, we'll get right on it. And they'd spend the next 6 months building out some big website that falls down because they didn't actually go out and talk to the people that they were trying to solve problems for. They just assumed that it would work.
That's a tough assumption to make.
And unfortunately, it happens more times than not, I think. In companies today, they tend to say things like, you know, we don't have time for research. We don't have the money to do a bunch of work up front. We just need to build this thing. And, you know, my response to that is, well, you're still making a prototype. You're just making a really expensive one.
We don't have time to build it right, but we have time and money to build it twice.
Exactly.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release, deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So where do you move on to from there?
From there, I worked at Sotheby's in Manhattan for a little bit. I helped them redesign their website. That was really nice to bring my career back to the fine arts realm. So I was like around paintings and it was very familiar to me. So that was nice. But when I was at Sotheby's, I was working on the information architecture, and I would try not to fight. I would try not to fight or argue, but every once in a while I would throw something out there like, you know, do we think that it might be useful to get maybe five $100 gift cards to the wine store downstairs and just talk to five people that walk into this building and show and put it in front of them and say, can you click on a few things and then tell me what you think? Even that is better than nothing. And that actually is really good way to get to where you need to go, to figuring out and validating whether you're on the right track or not. So they wouldn't do that. And I ended up getting recruited actually from a good friend of mine to go work at a pharmaceutical advertising agency, Avast Life New York. And I worked there for a while as their director of UX. I basically went to a couple different places, a couple different positions. I learned so much about creating a product of value and how to do that. I think that I take lessons from some of the things that I had done in the past. So for instance, that story about Foundry 9 and me basically willing my own job
into existence.
Into existence. It helped me realize that, you know, that was possible because I was being honest with myself. I was being honest with other people. I was being completely transparent. And I think that that is one of the biggest lessons that I've learned as far as product design, UX, and then anybody's own career path. You kind of have to just be transparent and honest with everybody, because if you're not and you're hiding things, it's going to fall down. And you're going to either disappoint yourself, or you're going to disappoint coworkers, or the product isn't going to work, or any number of things. So I think, you know, going into any situation with humility and transparency, along with that passion to do what you want to do because you're now being honest with yourself, that's the best way to move forward.
Now, I think the next leap forward is you moving into the financial services industry with LeapFrog.
Yeah, so I ended up going to LeapFrog. They had me working as a director of UX for a very small group within Bank of New York Mellon. They all thought of it as like I was the guy in the garage. I was the little startup within the big company. And I was helping to work on a mobile-first platform for performance and risk analytics, so that, you know, people in the C-suite or people making these decisions on investment and institutional investing, they could actually check out some instantaneous feedback from anywhere. You know, they're usually on a computer or they're on something. So this would allow them to, you know, check some of that stuff. That was a great product. We actually ended up making it. And then I think they had some reason why they had to move forward with a different product. There was another product that was very similar at the same time. And, you know, they just decided not to continue with that path. So I ended up leaving, but now I'm back there. And I'm not a consultant. I'm now working at BNY Mellon.
How'd that come about?
I kept in touch with some people. I always try and keep my connections, you know, networking is super important. And so, you know, I just, every once in a while, I reach out to people that I worked with in the past or on LinkedIn or whatever. And I try and make networking as part of my routine. Usually in the morning, I'll spend maybe 10 or 15 minutes on LinkedIn or something just to throw a couple messages out there. And what happened was I found out that BNY Mellon was looking for a head of UX position. And so I applied, and it came down to me and somebody else, and that other person got the role. I went and I said, okay, well, you know, that no big deal. And I told them, I said, would it be okay if we still kept in touch? Because I know that you never know what's going to happen. And I'm still interested in working at BNY Mellon, believe it or not. I want to work with you guys, so I want to keep in touch. And they were actually pretty impressed with that. So they said yes. And every few months, I would reach back out to the person that interviewed me. Well, a year later, it turns out that the person that got that job ended up taking another role and leaving. So they reached back out to me, and it felt very much like the Foundry 9 position, where they were like, okay, like you're the only one applying for this job. We already interviewed you. We really want you to work on it, but you got to go through an interview again. So I interviewed again and ended up getting the role. And that's what I'm doing today.
And so what are you doing day to day? Are you designing and providing IA for apps, or what are you doing?
Now I'm more of a management role. So I have a couple of designers that work with me on different products. So I'm a little bit more into the organization, a little bit more into design ops. So figuring out different processes and the different design stacks that we should be using and things of that nature, the governance behind what we're doing. You know, I run a weekly design design critique. I run design planning sessions, my one-to-ones. So I'm not directly creating things like the information architecture, but the people that I manage do. So I have say in it at the end.
So moving from being hands-on individual contributor, information architect to managing, and also you mentioned I've killed the wireframe in my sketchbook and now things have evolved. What have you seen change over the years? What is part of that design ops and like helping the new IAs do their job?
I think the entire industry has really moved from what I used to call an obituary of documentation. I used to work on these documents, like when I was at Sotheby's, we had a 200 to 300 pages of a wireframe that every single interaction that you could possibly imagine that was going to happen on the site was documented, described, you know, every state shown, everything, everything that you could possibly imagine. And there was maybe like three people that read it.
It's kind of like write only.
Yeah. So like, so that was one of the things that I learned in that role too, is people ask for this documentation because they think that that's the best way to do it. But in actuality, you know, you end up printing out this big PDF and it thunks on someone's desk and then you turn the corner and it's thunking right in their garbage can. So it's not necessarily needed. Today, I think that there's so many great technologies that speed up the process and allow for teams to go from assumption to validation a lot faster. If you don't have to spend 6 months creating a 300-page document before a finger hits a keyboard where somebody starts to code something, yeah, you're doing it wrong.
What are some of your favorite tools these days that you see people using?
In the shop that I'm at, we're a Figma team. People like Figma. I wouldn't call myself an expert at Figma at all. I actually never used it before I came to this team. I was more in Sketch and InVision. But Figma, it's the same animal. I've been through all the technologies that I have to use for all those documentation stuff. And, you know, I was at one point very proud of my skills in Visio, where, you know, people are like, what's Visio now? But yeah, I mean, I was like writing my own macros and it was good at the time, but now we've got a way to go from designing in your sketchbook, drawing some boxes and putting some arrows down and getting a picture down in your head from the sketchbook and going right from there to an actionable prototype that you can actually put in front of people and say, hey, what do you think about this? Or can you go ahead and find your profile and then watch them sit there and not find their profile? I mean, that's the fun part for me with UX design is watching people fumble around and, you know, things that all those serendipitous things that you find in testing that you just didn't expect. Cause, you know, doesn't everybody go to the find their profile in the same place? And doesn't everybody use the same, you know, link or think of it in the same way? And you just, you learn in UX right away that no, no matter how you make something, you will, if you put it in front of users, you will enjoy watching people stumble and fall because you know that that's how you're going to make your product better.
See, as a developer, like when I would sit in on those sessions, it would feel like panic and like you're rooting for the person to like find the happy path and they're just not and you're dying a little bit inside.
Yeah, I remember that too. I remember those days from in Nickelodeon, but for that was, we never got a chance to put it in front of users. So that was just the QA team. So we'd be like, okay, this is ready for QA. And I would be a mess. I'd be like, okay, I'm going out for pizza or something.
Now, you mentioned the norm in the industry was to have what Mark Carberry, a previous episode of Underserved, had referred to as thunk factor. Like if your thing can go thunk when it lands on the desk, then it feels sufficiently well thought through. And the same thing happened on the development side. We used to have gigantic design docs and business analysts writing tomes about use cases and so on. And now the project has gotten much more leaner and agile. It sounds like the same sort of thing is happening in IA.
I think it's happening with all the improvements of the tools and, you know, the things that we use to create these deliverables.
Now, you mentioned you had joined some groups earlier in your career, but it looks like you're still a member of a few in the Boston area.
Yeah, I was on the board of directors for 3 years for UXPA Boston. But I think the biggest thing that I did was I started World Information Architecture Day for Boston. It's a one-day conference. that I was able to get some really big names to come. And my goal was at all times to not charge any money for people to come. So most of the time I worked on getting sponsors, but the other things that I would have to do was, you know, fly people in, figure out how to pay for their stay and all those great things. But I did that for a good 4 or 5 years. And that conference at its peak saw maybe 300 or 400 people. You know, it was held at HubSpot a couple of years. And yeah, it was great, great thing. I had the first keynote that I got was Peter Morville, who he wrote the information architecture book, the polar bear book, as they call it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Any other notable speakers at World IA Day?
Oh, yeah. So some of my favorites were Steve Portigal. He wrote a book called Interviewing Users, Rosenfeld Media. He's a great guy. He's so much fun. And then Josh Seiden. So Josh Seiden, he worked with Jeff Gottelf on the book Lean UX. And then they just came out with another book called Sense and Respond. So all these ideas around mitigating waste and getting to a point of validation as fast as possible. So that's where I've learned all those great things from all those people. But yeah, I've had a ton of people that I've flown in from Seattle or California and gotten them to talk. And the reason why I was doing it was because, you know, I made the move from New York to Boston about 5 years ago. And when I did that, I didn't know anybody. So I thought to myself, you know, all right, put on my networking hat. Like, what? How do I do this? What do I do? And I figured the best way to start would be to organize a conference. And it was extremely stressful, but it worked. I ended up meeting so many people in the UX community in Boston and learning how awesome the community is here and, you know, how empathetic and wonderful other designers are. And it was just a great, great thing.
That's pretty ambitious. Like most people in the tech industry that transplant from New York to Boston are like, maybe I'll attend a meetup.
Yeah.
Not, I'll organize a 400 person conference with guests flown, you know, speakers flown in from across the country.
Yeah. I think I wanted something that I would want to go to. So I didn't see it happening and figured, you know what? Let me just give it a shot. Let me try and do it myself.
I imagine COVID kind of put the kibosh on doing that the last couple of years.
Yep. Yep. I was trying to transition off from being the main organizer. I had my buddy Dan. He was getting ready to take it over. But yeah, then COVID hit and I don't even know if it's still going on. I know that World IA Day still happens, but I think it's all virtual and I don't think the one in Boston's going on.
Are there any other groups that you are involved in Boston these days?
No, I think those are the main ones. Really, you know, UXPA is a huge group in Boston.
What does that stand for?
User Experience Professionals Association.
Okay.
It's one of the biggest chapters that they have around the world is in Boston. In New York, on the other hand, IXDA is a little bit bigger than UXPA. So I was just more involved with that group when I was in New York. And then I made that. I think every town, city, whatever, you know, you got to kind of just go in and see what's working, what's not working, figure out where everybody is, where they're at, you know.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing when you're not buried in UX and managing IA folks at work? Like, what do you do outside of work for fun?
Well, I have a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old right now. So planning a trip to Disney, all those great things, driving kids to baseball practice and all that good stuff.
I see a lot of people going to the new Star Wars exhibits there, and I see posts on like Facebook constantly, so I'm sure you guys will have a ball when you go.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I can't wait. I've actually never been to Universal Studios, so I want to do that.
Nice.
Yeah.
If you have enjoyed our episode today and want to find out more about the topics we discussed, head on over to our website, underserved.fm. There you will find show notes for this episode, including links that we've curated to provide you with further information. On our website, you'll also find our complete back catalog of episodes in case you missed one, or if you're a completist and want to hear them all. There are also links there to subscribe to Underserved with your favorite podcast client so you don't miss any upcoming episodes. That URL again is underserved.fm, like FM radio. So Brian, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Andrew, thank you so much for having me.
It's been a lot of fun, and we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.